Thank you for downloading or streaming this episode of Band Biographies. You can find more episodes at bandbiographies.com. That's B-A-N-N-E-D biographies.com. If you enjoy it, why not leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts? Apparently, it helps get the show up the charts so more people can see it, to download it, and then to leave further 5-star reviews. Another way you can help is by telling as many friends as possible to give it a download. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, on Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for BandBiographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. But most of all, enjoy. Welcome to this extra special interview episode of Band Biographies, where I was very lucky to sit down for about 90 minutes over Zoom with Rick McMurray, the drummer from Ash. If this is your first time listening to Band Biographies, please do go back through the back catalogue of episodes. There aren't loads of them, and there's a nice mix now of documentaries on bands like The Undertones, Susie and the Banshees, Sex Pistols, Adam and the Ants, The Slits and Billy Idol, as well as interviews with Paul Brightman of Sham 69, the women's lib band The Stepney Sisters, the Pete Shelley Memorial Campaign, and Louise Aubrey. And don't forget to subscribe and leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Or get in touch with me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. Ash is a band I've been listening to since I heard the song Lose Control on the soundtrack of Gran Turismo in the mid to late 90s. Their first full-length album, 1977, was released 25 years ago and went straight to number one on the UK album charts. To commemorate that, Ash are playing the album in its entirety on the 5th of June, which you can sign up to watch through the band's website, ashofficial.com. There are various bundles available, from watching the concert only, right up to getting an unlimited 30-day access to the show, behind-the-scenes documentary, a bonus performance, a limited 1977 frisbee, as well as a limited edition 1977 t-shirt. All tiers are well worth the money. Rick was incredibly candid with me about the highs and lows of Ash's career, as well as talking about the horror film Slashed, which starred the band. He also told me about sitting down for a meal with Joe Strummer, and getting Mickey Bradley and Damien O'Neill on the last Ash album, and so much more. He didn't even want to see the questions before our chat, and was happy not to review the edit, so I've kept it unedited, except for the odd bit of me getting tongue-tied on certain questions. I'm so honoured and thankful to Rick for giving up a part of his morning to talk to me, and I hope you get some great insights into the man himself, and the life of a professional musician, and how that's changed over the last 3 decades. So without further ado, I give to you Rick McMurray from Ash. I'm here today with Rick McMurray. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me. Good to be here.
Yeah, no, it's great. And especially at this time as well, the first thing that tends to always happen in these conversations is, how has your last year been? Because it's been an interesting one.
Yeah.
Both as kind of you in yourself and as part of what is normally a touring band.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey. I guess if we want to say the last year started with all the COVID pandemic, that was an interesting way to sort of prematurely finish up our touring plans for Teenage Wildlife. We'd started out in Europe, I guess February, and it was a bit of a roller coaster in itself, because our regular tour manager had to pull out last minute for family issues. So I was like, yeah, I'll do that. I'll step in. We need everything set up anyway, and it wasn't quite like it was being chucked in at the deep end, but it was the first time I'd done it before. So I was like kind of covering all the day-to-day stuff for him, and that was I kind of enjoyed the challenge of it, but it was kind of a lot to take on. But I kind of enjoyed being busy, but you know, maybe doing that in the middle of what turned into a worldwide pandemic wasn't the best introduction to it. So, but yeah, I mean, we were excited to get out on the road and do the best of it. It was a while since we'd done such an extensive tour in Europe, but unfortunately, the second date of the tour, I think, was in or maybe it was the third, I think it was the third date of the tour, was supposed to be in Bologna,
right?
Which, like, after, I think after day one of the tour, we knew that was wasn't happening.
Oh,
I
wow.
Was, okay, right, well, we'll, you know, we're not going to Italy, it's locked down, we're staying away. But, you know, I think the closest we got to Italy, that which was, we had a day off in Munich, we went to, hung out in beer kellers, had a good time, and then went to Switzerland. And the day we got to Switzerland, they cancelled everything. Like, I think it was above 2,000 capacity, which thankfully didn't affect our gig, but you know, the promoter was dealing with all the craziness going on and trying to cancel. I think that time of year is a big deal in Switzerland. There's lots of festival stuff going on.
Right.
So, yeah, we managed to get out of there okay. We started heading north, and we're like, okay, we're getting out of the danger zone. We should be all right. But, you know, it was just like, it was like fighting a losing battle with it. So we eventually ground to a halt after a few pretty crazy days, actually, in Norway. We played in Bergen. It's a club that we absolutely love. I think the first time we did it was back in 1999. It's an old air raid shelter built into the side of a cliff.
Oh, wow.
And it's like really, it's like 300 capacity or something like that, which we'd sold out. We hadn't been there for 10 years. It was like, this is going to be amazing.
Yeah.
So, you know, we did the usual, got in, set up, sound checked, got ready. The support band were putting their gear on stage, getting ready. And then the promoter came to the tour manager, i.e. me, and was told me that the government had just brought in restrictions where everyone in the club needed 1 meter space,
right,
for it to go ahead. Otherwise, the gig would be cancelled. And I'm like, "What are options here?" He's like, "Well, you can cancel, or we can go ahead. But if we go ahead, we're the only gig in town, and someone will turn up. And if people don't have the space, I'll probably get arrested." And I was like, "Okay, well, you know, that'll make a pretty good story." I was like, "Oh, are you up for getting arrested?" He's like, "I don't think so." I was like, okay, any other options? He's like, well, we can move. There's a larger venue, like, I think it was like 1,200 capacity. Like, Bergen's quite a small place, built in the cliffside, so it was basically the bottom of the hill. So at like, I don't know, maybe 5:30, we made the decision to pack the entire gig up and go down to this club and just start from scratch again. So it was a great feeling that we managed to pull that gig off and everything that was going on. And, you know, the TV crew showed up and were doing vox pops with the audience about, you know, how it felt like to, you know, be out on in these crazy times. So it's like to be able to pull that gig off in such a short space of time and not cancel it, we just felt like, you know, total heroes.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, it would have been nice if that was the last gig, but the following day we played in Stavanger, which I think that was the day when it was announced that it was a worldwide pandemic.
Right.
And so half the people who bought tickets didn't show up. They were obviously keeping their distance from the stage. And it was just like, kind of felt like a weird way to end it. And we come off stage finding that two gigs had been cancelled coming up. And there was like one gig in Hamburg in the middle of those gigs. So we had to go to Hamburg and hang out for a couple of days. And that got cancelled in the morning of the show. So then it was just like a dash to Calais to get back to the UK. And got home, and still we had our UK tour was still on, you know, still it was starting. This was the 15th we got back home, late in the 15th. We cancelled the UK tour was supposed to start on the 17th, and we cancelled that like late afternoon on the 16th. So that was like pretty crazy times.
Yeah, it was mad, wasn't it? Because the venues and the bands and comedians and such were kind of left to figure it out. Like, do you want to cancel it? And it's like, well, surely we should be being told.
Yeah. I mean, that was a really tough one for us as well. You know, even, I guess that was happening in Germany as well, which was, you know, I think the promoter on the morning of the Hamburg show had rung up and said, I'll give you some money to cancel the show, because they didn't want to take the responsibility for it, because they'd be left out of pocket, I guess. But yeah, kind of made us the bad guys, but I understand why they did it. But then, you know, the UK, things were still going ahead, and we were seeing what was happening with, like, you know, I think the Stereophonics were getting like so much grief online. It's like, you know, it's like, of course we want to continue the tour, but we want to be safe for our audience. So we just felt we were left in this really difficult position, and we just had to, you know, bite the bullet and say, right, we're going to postpone this until it's safe. But, you know, little did we know that it was going to be, you know,
14 months later or whatever.
Yeah, well, I guess it's going to be like close, like September, if September happens, which currently, you know, touch everything. It is. That's like almost 18 months after it should have happened. So, yeah.
So are you basically picking up where you left off, or have you had to reorganize the entire tour?
I mean, the tour has been, it's been it's been postponed and it's been rescheduled. I don't know how many times now, I'm losing count. I mean, it's like, it's the biggest nightmare for everyone involved, you know, especially the agents and promoters, just like trying to living in hope that, you know, things are going to happen soon, rescheduling stuff, and then having to cancel again and reschedule. It's just, it's been a headache. But I think, you know, if and when we get back to it, it's going to be the biggest kind of release.
It really is, isn't it? I think there's a real kind of thirst from people who like to go to gigs on a regular basis to get back out there. And obviously the bands haven't been able to do it for, well, like you say, what will be about 18 months. And I think there will just be this amazing kind of everyone giving 110%. Like the bands are going to be giving it, the audiences are going to be giving it back. I think it's going to be amazing once it's back.
You know, I think there might be an element of kind of weirdness going back to it as well. You know, it's like just, you know, I guess the anticipation of going back into that thing where it's, you know, you've lived with the idea that doing this is kind of dangerous, you know, potentially fatal. But I think once people sort of like dip their toe in, it's like the, I think that weirdness will sort of like just, it's almost like the last 18 months will just like kind of vanish. You're back at, you know, what you're doing in 11.
Yeah, absolutely. And talking of gigs as well, obviously you're playing a 25th anniversary live stream as well coming up on the, is it the 5th? Or the
5th of June.
So how's that? I assume you were probably planning on doing this live at some point, or is this just come about because of the pandemic?
It was mostly because of, I think, you know, if COVID hadn't happened, you know, we'd have the best of tour, be sort of done and dusted. We would have had time to sort of sit down and plan. It's a big, you know, 25 years, big anniversary. It's like we would have done something, but I guess, you know, our minds have been kind of concentrated on just, you know, catching up to where we should be. But then it was a case of, oh, what, we've got this anniversary coming up, we need to do something. So this was like the perfect solution in these crazy times. I mean, it's like, you know, it was, maybe we could have held off until the end of the year, but we kind of didn't want to be doing like a 1977 tour and a best of tour, like you know, a couple of months apart. So like having it as a live online event is kind of the, under the circumstances, the best kind of option, I think. So it's exciting to be able to do that. It's exciting to have, we actually recorded it last week. So it's as live thing. So it was a bit weird kind of like thinking about it, you know. It's like I think like a couple of days leading up to it, we're like, you know, how's this going to work in terms of there not being an audience in the room?
Yeah, but, I can imagine it's really weird.
It actually wasn't. It was like, because we pretty much played the whole thing as a live gig. You know, we wanted to, you know, roll the songs together and, you know, play it like as much as possible. It felt like a live set. Plus, like having, you know, they've got like the audio crew and got the video crew and stuff that there. It's like, it's almost like, you know, I've said it before to the guys. It's like, even if you're in a rehearsal room, if someone shows up at the rehearsal room, like, you know, like a member of like management or whatever. And I mean, probably not so much the crew, because we're used to having our crew around. But if someone who's not normally there turns up, it's almost like you just go like, oh, it's an audience, even if it's one person. You just, like, a switch kind of goes off, and it's just like you're not rehearsing at that point; you're performing. So it worked really well.
Oh, brilliant!
I'm excited to see the results of it.
Yeah, as am I. I've got my ticket, so looking forward to it.
And we've pulled out, you know, full, you know, it's obviously it's the full album, but we pulled out an interesting bunch of extra songs to add in as well.
Okay.
Yeah, there's going to be a few surprises in there. It's probably, I think, at least two that we probably never played live before. We certainly never played them in the 1977 show before. So.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. Intriguing. I like it. And kind of going back to that time and before, what was it? Because Tim and Mark were in an Iron Maiden tribute band, right? Called Vietnam back in the day.
Yeah, I think it wasn't so much a tribute band. I think the idea was like, you know, they're very much inspired by Iron Maiden, but they got their guitars and they were like, they very quickly realized that, you know, Iron Maiden was way beyond them. So that I think that kind of worked out for them, because that's they just had to start writing their own songs immediately because they couldn't play anything they were inspired by. So that was the case. Yeah, it was kind of a metal band. They started like as soon as they got guitars and roped in a few other people and
So when did you meet those guys?
I actually saw them playing in their previous incarnation a couple of times. There's the local arts center, and they played like for, I think it was like a children in need fundraiser at school as well, along with there's a couple of other bands. There was one band called Laser Gun Nun who played as well. And they were like the cool kids, a couple of years older than us, who introduced us to the likes of, you know, like Mudhoney and Soundgarden and Stooges and Nirvana. They were doing like sort of their own songs and covers of these guys, you know, so very much that sort of like Seattle, like, you know, punk 2.0 kind of thing going on. So, and I think it was around the time that Nirvana exploded, that was like also like a big sort of like inspiration to Tim and Mark. Sort of like they disbanded the metal band and just started looking for someone else of a sort of like a similar mindset. So I think I met Tim at the school play.
Right.
It was a weird play. I can't remember who wrote it, but it was a Russian play. It was called The Suicide.
Okay.
I was playing a drunken detective in it, and Tim was like a gypsy musician. So I think he was playing guitar, and I went over and said, do you mind if I have a go on the guitar, sort of playing stuff? And he was like, I'm getting together with a few friends over the, I think it was Easter holidays or whatever, just to, you know, do a few covers. Do you want to come along? And I was like, well, I play drums as well. We've got a drummer. And he's like, oh no, perfect. Come along. So I went along to that. And that was my first introduction to being, you know, playing with other musicians. It was good fun. And then I think a couple of months after that, Tim invited me around again, but it was just him and Mark. It was like, okay, this is different. And he's like, yeah, we're just like, you know, we're restarting. You know, we got rid of like the old drummer and guitarist because they weren't really that committed. And he was like, do you want to join? So we started playing there, and then that's when we sort of like came up with the name Ash at that point. And yeah, sort of took, I think it was like a week later, we recorded our first demo.
Right.
It was six songs. So that was a pretty intense week.
I was going to say, it seems to me like doing a bit of reading behind the scenes and stuff, like everything happened really fast for you guys. Like you were all still in school when you got your first record deal as well, right? Like, how was that kind of being at school and getting a record deal? Like, were you, you know, I mean, I don't know what kind of person you were at school, what group you were in, but was that seen as like a cool thing to have?
We didn't really talk about it, to be honest. It was just sort of one of those things that I think there wasn't very many of our friends, like the people who already knew we were in bands, probably told them. I can't remember, to be honest, but most of the people I went to school with, you know, weren't really into like that much alternative music, so it was very much under the radar. But yeah, I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, it's like, I think, you know, from an outside perspective, it was quite quick, but I think for us, it felt like a long time. I guess when you start at 15, you know, it's like we got a record deal at age 17, so it's like 2 years of your life, like a big, it's quite a big percentage, I guess. But also we'd had, I can't even remember the name of the label now, but it was band, I don't know if you remember a band called Dizzy Chainsaw.
It rings a bell. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they were, I think we covered one of their song called Love Your Money. We covered back in the day, but we'd sent off demo tapes to their label, and their label sort of like briefly been in touch and sort of like, we're kind of interested. And then they suddenly disappeared. So that was like probably a year before we get signed. So we were kind of like, you know, 15, we start a band. At 16, we're disillusioned because, you know, no one wants to hear. So we're just like, you know, what we doing? we got like a little bit frustrated at it. But there was a lot of naivety there. But, you know, we kind of got, you know, like a few months later, we got like a bit of luck and, you know, a demo tape got into the right hands. And through that, we got our first single, convinced the guy who put out the first single to become our manager. And things sort of like took off from there.
Yeah, yeah. Because what were you listening to growing up?
I guess early days, I mean, same for me. It was like Iron Maiden was probably one of the first bands I got into. Although I remember being like really young, probably about, I don't know, like 9 or 10, having this like cool babysitter who was like, her boyfriend was like, he was like proper mod and had the Vespa bike and stuff and everything in the big parka. And she was like bringing up like cassettes of like that he made for her of like The Who and The Kinks and probably like Small Faces and stuff like that. So I remember listening to that and just like going, wow, this is different. This is not what you hear on Top of the Pop. And being really into that, and then sort of like started finding sort of music. I mean, me and my brother kind of finding music of our own. It was like Iron Maiden, and you know, I had a couple of years of being very into metal.
Yeah.
And then sort of like slowly finding my way back to like sort of like Beatles and Stones stuff.
Yeah, it takes a while sometimes to get back to the originators, doesn't it? I had that myself, like get into the heavier stuff and work backwards.
Yeah.
Because was there music on at home when you were growing up? Did your parents, were your parents into music, or, you know, brothers and sisters?
My brother, he was like, he had a couple of mates. My older brother, like he played guitar. And I sort of like kind of took that on. He probably stopped playing as much, and I kind of like got a guitar. I first started playing guitar and then started getting drums when I was probably 13. But yeah, my parents didn't play a huge amount of music. I mean, there was a little bit around, but they didn't have a massive collection. You know, there was like a few, I was trying to think of any albums. Yeah, there was a lot of singles kicking about. I think there was like Mull of Kintyre by the Beatles. I remember getting that when I was really young. And, you know, getting like compilation albums at Christmas and things like that. So there's a little bit about it, but not massive amounts. My mum played a little bit of piano, but not very regularly. Like I remember like when I was probably about 5 or 6, mum like going and getting a secondhand piano and that being in the house. And my brother was sent for lessons, and then it was my turn to be sent for lessons. He didn't want to do it, and I remember just like, I must have been about 6 or 7, and just like screaming my head off, going, I don't want to do this. Which, of course, I regret that these days. But I think it's one of those things where, you know, you have to want to do it. Otherwise, it's just like it can really put you off. So
definitely. Yeah, I agree with that. Were the kind of mod records that your babysitter was bringing around, were they the first kind of songs that really kind of grabbed you and thought, oh, that seems like something I think I can do? Or was it later on?
Probably a little later on where I sort of thinking, you know, I can do this. I remember my brother had like the Iron Maiden's Live After Death LP. I remember sort of looking at that and I tried a little bit of guitar, and you know, it was like the Iron Maiden stuff was just like, what? You know, what are they doing? I don't know, I have no idea even how to begin to do that. And I remember saying to him, like, well, what do you think the easiest job in a band is? And he was like, drummer. And I was like, okay. So that probably sat in my subconscious for a long time. But I remember, you know, it's like I continued to play guitar and finding sort of bands that, you know, where it was simple enough where I could play guitar to.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, for some reason, it's just like, I was listening to something, just the drums just were suddenly like really present. I was kind of listening to it, going like, okay, I can really hear what he's doing there, and just sort of like started tapping along. And then it was like, I want a drum kit, which I think, you know, my parents were probably against for a little while, but I think once they gave up on the idea of me having any friends in my teenage years, they took pity on me. And it was a couple of months after Christmas, because I think I asked for a drum kit at Christmas and they were like, no. But then they just arrived home with this drum kit in the car, and I was just like, mind blown. So like, set the drum kit up in my room, turned the stereo up to like full blast, and started playing along with stuff.
Excellent. Any complaints from the neighbors?
Never had any complaints from the neighbors.
Really?
I was for whatever reason. Yeah.
Oh, excellent. Because that's always the thing, you know. Drums are one of the more kind of bulky and loud. You can't turn drums down, really, can you?
Yeah. Especially back then when there wasn't really, you know, there wasn't really any budget electronic kits or anything like that. It was just the real thing or nothing, or the real thing in a pillow, I guess.
Yeah. So after the the release of Trailer in 1977, I mean, 1977 went to number one, like first album out of the gate, basically. How was that? I mean, because you were kind of, Ash were kind of lumped in with the Britpop movement, and that's kind of, it kind of it covered a whole bunch of different bands and acts, from like the Spice Girls right the way through to Bush, I suppose, at the other kind of heavier, grungier end of things.
I think they were kind of pretty much stretching the envelope with the Britpop tag. With us, I mean, it was a fun time to be around. It was exciting having, music from the UK. There was guitar music in the charts, but you know, we didn't particularly feel like we fit in, considering our influences were very much more American, especially, you know, starting out with like Nirvana, Pixies, stuff like that. You know, it's like we're definitely more. I'm not sure if Britpop really had a punk end to the spectrum or not. You know, it's like,
you were about the only band in that punk bit of the spectrum, I think.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a kind of interesting, you know, having done the 1977 live broadcast show, having recorded that, and kind of looking back on it and going like, the singles can be quite pop, you know, especially the Girl from Mars and Angel Interceptor, but there's a lot of stuff in that album which is quite dark, you know, certainly compared to later, because it's kind of weird that scene is a big commercial album when you've got stuff like Innocent Smile on there and Dark Side, Light Side, and I'd Give You Anything, like all of which is like, you know, there's a lot of Sonic Youth and a lot of Stooges in those three songs as well. So yeah, it's kind of interesting that we were seen as this big pop phenomenon. I guess we're getting press from, you know, everywhere, from like Kerrang to like smash hits, which is just, you know, there's probably quite a select bunch of bands that have like covered those in the same record.
Yeah, it's crazy, really, because I remember the first thing that really struck me about 1977 was just the opening sound of the TIE Fighter, or whatever it was. It sounded like a TIE Fighter to me anyway.
It is a TIE Fighter, yeah.
And I was like, right, this is it. Like, these guys are on the same tip as me, being a massive Star Wars fan. Like, yeah.
Not quite sure how we didn't get sued for that, but there you go. we did just completely lift that.
But it was the Wild West, wasn't it? You know, the kind of 90s. I mean, it's the reason that you can't find any De La Soul albums from that era, is because they were just lifting samples without getting any kind of copyright permission.
Yeah.
They're nowhere.
Yeah. We slipped under the radar with that one for sure.
And it seems like within the first five albums were all kind of top 10 charters.
Yeah.
It just seems like you guys kind of hit the ground running. I don't know. Did it feel like, because obviously it came with the first outing, the number one. Did that feel unreal, or did it feel kind of natural?
In some ways, it felt kind of a bit of both, really. Because in some ways, it felt like Well, yeah, of course it's gone to number one, because like everything we've done is like everything we did from like from we started just got bigger and bigger, which was our first, I guess our first proper release in Infectious Petrol was like that was in the indie chart top 10, which was just mind blowing for us. And then Uncle Pat was in there as well. And as we started releasing like the singles just before 1977, like we recorded Kung Fu like a year before, and Girl from Mars. So we had like Kung Fu, Girl from Mars, Angel Interceptor, and just felt like we kept growing. And then Goldfinger before the album, that was like top five singles. So it was just like this. We could kind of see this trajectory, but at the same time, it was just like when that actually did go to number one, it was just like, this is nuts. This is like, it's the most popular album or new album like this week in this country. And it was just like, yeah. So that was nuts. And it was like, there was a weird, I guess, it was like, it didn't last long, but we had this sort of weird, like, right, we've made it kind of moment. But we didn't really consider like the implications of that. It was just like, oh, great, we can relax now. But that's when, having that's when the record company wanted us to go out and just like promote it throughout the world and stuff. And it was, we'd already had that first little taste of touring the world with Trailer. I think once Girl from Mars came out, we were kind of touring Trailer like belatedly, like around the world. We're going to like America and Japan, Australia, and into Europe. So that was, we'd sort of done that, and then we're sort of doing it again, but this time it's really intense because everyone's like wanted to interview us every day, and we're just wanting to party and enjoy our success. So it was like there was like a bit of, I guess, I don't know. It didn't feel as sort of like amazing as we felt it should, because it kind of took a lot out of us, and we weren't, I guess, I think, probably people in management and record company tried to prepare us for it, but we, it's not like we were listening, we were too drunk to listen.
Well, that's it. How can you be prepared for that? You've just kind of, like I say, it's you weren't long out of school and all of a sudden, bang.
Yeah, so we kind of all of that, and then once we'd finished kind of touring that, it was a case of, right, where's the next album? And it's like, well, we've just been touring and doing interviews for like an entire year here. We haven't, I think Tim hadn't even managed to sit down and write a song for over a year, which was just bizarre. So then there was all this pressure and, no writing having happened. And that's kind of when the, a few cracks kind of started to show. And I remember when Tim was writing The Life Less Ordinary, he basically had the song written, but he put so much pressure on himself. He'd come up with like, I don't know, like probably, I remember he had like about three different chord progressions for the sort of bridge into the chorus and stuff. And
Right.
just, you could see it was just like doing his head in. He was going like, is this any good? And starting to sort of like, you'd see the pressure was getting to him at that point. But that came out and it did well. But then it was like a case of like trying to write an album. Charlotte joined the band as well, so there's so much going on. Just it inevitably led to sort of writer's block, and the record company like booked us this like kind of writing studio, which was in the middle of nowhere.
Okay.
Sort of like all the band were like kind of in a house together with like our sound engineer at the time, and Tim was little cottage by himself, and he was just like kind of locked away there and was just going like, what's he doing? And like, there was no songs coming. We were just like messing around with a few little bits that we had, but kind of knew that it was his songs that we were looking for. But so that was a tough time, and getting that album out, it's like it's a weird time to look back on for us, because there was a lot of stress
Yeah. And do you,
involved.
was Charlotte coming in, was that to kind of help the process along, or was that completely separate from kind of, having to write an album, as soon as you got back from a massive world tour?
Yeah, it was kind of weird. I mean, it was probably good, like a welcome distraction in a way. Like, but I mean, she did like a like probably it was probably half a summer's worth of sort of gigs and festivals, and then we released Life Less Ordinary.
Mm.
And then she just came, like, even though she lived in London, she was just outside London at this weird secluded farmhouse, like somewhere that was near between Gatwick and Brighton.
Right. Okay.
And we were, yeah, she was there with us, just sort of sitting around. We're just like drinking, smoking weed, waiting to write things. So we were there. I think we must have been there for like about 2 months.
Right.
Or close to it. So, you know, we come out of that with, like, towards the end of it, we eventually come out with probably a decent amount of material. I think not quite everything was finished, but we sort of like managed to drag an album out of ourselves and get into the studio. And even the recording of that album was difficult because we worked with a different producer to begin with.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it's like the tracking stuff like started quite well. But then when we got to the mixing stage, it was very apparent that, you know, it just wasn't sounding like us.
Yeah. And so, your regular producer and mixer, was that Owen Morris?
Yeah.
What was it about him? Because he's on quite a few of those early Ash records. What did he bring to the table that you guys liked so much?
I don't know. It was just craziness and enthusiasm and a bit of madness. It just kind of, I guess when we'd done Trailer, it was very much sort of get into the studio. And like, I think we were pretty much still learning how to play at that point. So it was like a very laborious process, and it wasn't a massive amount of fun. We did like so many takes of each song just because, you know, we weren't that good. It had to be done. But I think with Owen, there was this sort of vibe. And, you know, I guess when we started working with him, we'd done a little bit. Yeah, we'd done some touring, so we'd gotten better, you know. But also he kind of just made it this just unique experience. Like for us, it was just like, you know, like we're like staying up all night until like 6 a.m. recording, taking various substances and just getting on a vibe with stuff. And he's very direct and honest about stuff. And stuff wasn't good enough, he'd really pushed him to go away and rewrite the lyrics or whatever. And, you know, really, it was definitely more of a production thing, whereas, you know, before it was just a case of trying to get the songs down. This was, you know, like play it like this. We'd probably half the material ready when we started in 1977. And it was a case of kind of routining stuff and going like, right, this is working, this isn't. It was just like, kind of felt like proper, like we're doing this for real at that point, you know?
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah. So when things started going south with like the Nuclear Sounds sessions, we're like, we need to get Owen back in. He's a total madman. Like we'd fall out with him just before we were due to go into the studio to do 1977, because he was just burnt out after doing the Be Here Now record.
Okay, yeah,
he wasn't the best place mentally, so I think he couldn't quite deal with us. So we sort of like, we'd started working with other people, but you know, once we got so far down the line with Nuclear Sounds, we kind of realized what we were missing, and it was definitely the right thing to do.
Yeah, I didn't realize that there was a lot of tension around during that time. I wasn't aware of that until, you know, kind of getting prepared for this. And it seems that the kind of comeback from that, when you flash forward to Free All Angels, it's such an upbeat album.
Yeah.
And the songs are so huge. And because that was my first Ash album, Free All Angels,
okay, right.
Which was the first one that I owned. I'd heard a couple of songs on like the Gran Turismo soundtracks.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And that was my introduction to a lot of bands, actually, because you had, you know, you had you guys, there was Garbage, Feeder, a bunch of other kind of acts on there. And later on, it was Muse as well, I think, were on one of them.
Yeah.
And they were great introductions to certain bands, I thought. But yeah, like the kind of fallout from the Nuclear Sounds session, was it a bit touch and go with record companies as well around that time? Because they kind of saw, even though Nuclear Sounds was like a number seven.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean,
that's still.
Yeah, it's kind of weird, you know, you think, you know, an album going to number seven, you think, oh, cool, you know, then great, right? But, you know, it was like coming off the back of a number one album, it's like anything that didn't go to number one was inevitably going to be perceived as you know, like a step backwards. So,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, the weird thing is, like, I guess going back to Nuclear Sons was because of 1977 being a number one album, there's this big, like, pressure to get like a follow-up and a successful follow-up. And when that didn't happen, in the record company's eyes, then the pressure suddenly disappeared. And that was just like, that was kind of weird for us as well, just like, because we'd never not had pressure, I guess, because everything had got like bigger and bigger every time. It was just like ramping up, and it was, you know, it was bound to crash at some point. But I think the thing for us on, like, before Free All Angels was, it was a case of, right, you know, it's like, because we put out Nuclear Sons, and we'd seen like a lot of our contemporaries were either like splitting up or being dropped by their labels and stuff. And there was definitely a sense of, you know, this could happen to us.
Mm.
But, you know, we were, I guess, what age were we then? Like 22, 23, going into our third album. And it was a case of, you know, it was like this, you know, it could be our last, mm-hmm. our last bite at the chair. I mean, the record company had, you know, committed to, they picked up the option for us to record a third album. It's like, right, okay, you know, it's like, it could be our last one. We're seeing everyone fall by the wayside here. So we were like, if it is going to be our last album, we want to go out with the biggest bang ever. It's got to be our best record. And I guess at that point, it was more like the pressure was like coming from within rather than sort of like, you know, pressure being forced upon us. So I think that's when it felt like a healthier kind of thing. And we just like picked up the mantle, and, you know, Tim spent a lot of time back at his parents' house and where we'd started the band. It was like kind of just getting in that vibe, and wrote a ton of stuff. But even at that, you know, I remember when he wrote Shining Light, because we were supposed to go and play with Joe Strummer that night in Belfast. Okay. We'd met him in Japan a couple of months before at Fuji Rock, and he'd like, his daughter was a massive fan, so he'd like taken us out for dinner, and we'd like had this massive night with him.
That's incredible.
Yeah, and it was bonkers. But like at the end of the night, he's like, oh yeah, I'm playing Belfast, if you guys are going to be around, let's get up and do I Fought the Law together. I was like,
wow,
great. So I remember from like on the night of the show, I remember like phoning Tim going like, are you going? He's got, no, I've just like written the start of this song. I think it's really good, so I want to stay and finish it. And I'm like, okay.
Oh my God.
I guess I can't really argue with that. So I went along and obviously didn't get up, just kind of watched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Great.
To pass up the chance of playing with Joe Strummer to write. I mean, admittedly, Shining Light is a brilliant song.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's a song that won Tim and Avril Lavigne, so. Yeah,
fair enough.
Hard to argue with, but you know. But yeah.
So what was hanging out with Joe Strummer like for that dinner in Japan?
That's bonkers. Yeah, I mean, I think we knew his tour manager was like a friend of our sound engineer. They worked in other bands before, but we bumped into them in it's called Tokyo Hands, which is a big like shopping center thing in Japan or whatever. It's multi-story, and it's just like, just all the weirdness of Japan. Every band goes to this place just to walk around and get some stuff that you can't get there. So we bumped into him. He's going like, oh yeah, oh, great to meet you. Do you want to come to me? I think we went for lunch or whatever. I can't remember what time. It was early enough in the day, but yeah, just went, he was so cool. He was just like, giving us loads of advice, just talking about his days in the Clash, and, you know, talking about the Egos, and just crazy stories about, you know, things that made being in a band difficult. And he's like, you know, we don't be going down that road. So yeah, no, it was amazing. And he's like, finished dinner, he's like, you know, come back to my hotel for a few drinks. And then he's like rolling joints in the lobby of the hotel. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, he's like, don't worry, it's fine. They don't even know what it smells like. They just think it's a cigarette.
That's incredible. But that's all I've ever heard of Joe Strummer. It's like he was always interested in the people he was interested in, and he would always kind of impart wisdom almost, you know, like
this well, absolutely, punk Buddha. Just an absolute passion for being in a band, and you know, for you know, and he's speaking about his experiences. Not to, you know, it's not like a case of like check me out. It's just like this is what we did. This is what we did. What I think we did wrong. Mm. This is where things went. You know, went by the wayside or whatever. So like, you know, it was like proper, you know, advice that you want to listen to. You know,
just, yeah.
And if you were talking, you listened.
Yeah, definitely, absolutely. Did you find any of it helpful? You know, did it help?
Probably. I think we were on a good, pretty good path. Well, I guess we were, because you know, we've managed to stick together for all these years. But yeah, I mean, it all made sense. You know, he's talking about, you know, like Mick Jones like refusing to get in the bus. In Toronto, I think, or unless someone goes and like, gets him a bag of weed,
right?
And they're just like sat there for like, you know, like 5 hours, and you know, missing gigs and stuff because people's egos are getting in the way and stuff like that. So we were never like that. I think we'd always had like quite a kind of work ethic. I mean, I can still to this day, I can probably count them one hand. The number of gigs we've cancelled, you know, so we never do that. And like going back to what I'm saying about, you know, the our Norway experience last year,
that's,
you know, stuff like that. You know, it's like putting on a gig against all odds is way more exciting than cancelling a gig. So we've always had, you know, we've always had that sort of like we'll do this. You know, we'll try if there's any way to do it, we'll do it. You know, so.
And I suppose, you know, with the release of Free Your Angels and the, you know, four or five, however many singles came off that album as well, like, did you feel that kicked you up into another gear? Because it was suddenly you were back on top again, like these songs that were coming out of you guys were just, you know, as you say, I mean, you know, shining like one Tim and Ivan Novello. So,
it felt like, you know, that got us back to where we had been on 1977. But you know, I think in many ways it's probably a stronger album as well. I think sort of like a bit more consistency to it. But I also think like, you know, second time around, if you like, it kind of felt like we could enjoy it a bit more. Relaxed, you know, we knew what we were going to be in for, and you know, it didn't have the weird psychological effects that maybe the first time Ron did. So we knew, like, go to number one, we this is going to happen, and we're kind of prepared for it.
Because you think it was a bit of a baptism of fire for Charlotte as well, kind of parachuting in during Nuclear Sounds and kind of finding herself in the middle of this kind of quite tense atmosphere, I guess.
Yeah, definitely. It must have been, you know, it'd be probably great to do an interview with her and get her perspective on on her ash years. But yeah, I mean, it's got to be a strange one. You know, it's like, I guess the weird thing, like, even I guess when we were going through the Nuclear Sounds thing, we were kind of looking at Charlotte like she's going through what we'd gone through beforehand. I guess maybe a little less pressure with the album not doing as well as 1977 had done. But then, you know, she's going through this by herself as well, if you like, you know. It's her first time. We'd already sort of like put ourselves through that ringer. So it was, kind of an interesting.
Yeah, but there's something about obviously the three of you guys, because also you had Russell Lissack from Block Party join as kind of live guitarist for a little while. Was that ever with a view to become a full member, or was it always going to be just like for a couple of tours?
I think we didn't really set out, we didn't really have any agenda with it. It was just with the A to Z thing. I think we kind of thought it would really benefit from another guitarist, and it timing was right, you know. I know Block Party had decided to take an extended break at that point, so Yeah, it was just a case of Russell's free, let's get him in and let's see what happens. It was a great time, but you know, it was like, I think we knew he was, you know, we knew Bloc Party hadn't split up, and knew that was his baby as well. So, but yeah.
But it's the, like I said, the core three of you seem to be like the thing that obviously you guys have been together ever since basically secondary school.
And
clearly it works, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think having Charlotte in the band for those years, I think when we were back to the three piece, we were very conscious about it. And, you know, it was like, I guess on Twilight of the Innocents, we were kind of like looking at different textures and stuff to fill that sort of guitar hole.
Mm.
And then A to Z, you know, we had Russell in, but I think with Russell, there was a few gigs that he didn't make. It was kind of last minute. He was like ill in Japan, and he had to go. I think he was producing some album in Japan right before our tour, and he had really bad jet lag, and he wasn't having a good time. So we landed as he took off, and we, you know, our tour starting the following day. And we're like, oh well, I guess it's going to be the three of us then. So when we, I think it was at that point, we went back to the three piece. We were just like, oh, you know what, this sounded pretty good as a three piece. So it was kind of like, those, I guess it was probably about 4 years where it kind of like took us to realize that the three piece thing was working for us, you know, we're comfortable with it. So,
yeah. No, I've been in bands that have kind of gone from three piece up to, I think at one point, one of them went up to like a six piece, and you're like, well, actually the easiest way to do this is just boil it down to the constituent parts.
Yeah.
It's easier to organize everyone for one thing.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like herding cats, it's so much easier with just three cats rather than five cats.
Glad to hear that. It's not just us.
No, absolutely.
Everything's planned.
And the other thing that I found out while doing some research into this was that you guys made like a low budget horror film called Slashed.
Yeah.
During one of the tours as well, and I watched a bit of you know, the only clip that I could find on the internet, and yeah, that was an interesting time. A bit trauma influence, quite kind of splattery.
Yeah. So it's very, it's very gory. But yeah, as we were, we'd been like touring America, and we were doing a lot of support stuff. I think we were like post Free All Angels. We spent almost, I think it was like 8 months, almost constantly on the road and in the States. And we were supporting a lot of bands out there, just trying to sort of break through. But with all this kind of downtime we had, we got a guy we know called Jed Shepherd, who's he's always been like a super fan. He's like emailing Mark, and he's going like, let's do a horror film, and he was just like sending us over like scripts of like bits of script, and it's sort of like it almost like spiraled out of control because we were doing a lot of festival stuff. In the States, and it was like Area 2, which was like Moby and David Bowie co-headline stuff. So we started roping in like anyone and everyone. I think there's Moby's in, like there's footage of Moby being like scene written, writing him into it. And we were doing some UK festivals as well.
Mm.
We got like Dave Grohl in it. We got like Chris Martin and Johnny from Coldplay. And we got Jimmy Nesbitt. I think there's a scene with Dave Grohl and Jimmy Nesbitt.
That's incredible.
Nesbitt was hanging around. So like, I think Mark was going like, oh, we're going to see so-and-so, and Jed would just come back with like his extra bit of script. So it sort of spiraled out of control and never got finished.
Yeah.
It's kind of, we've shown a few rushes of it. We did like a 20th anniversary thing at the Garage in London, where part of that, because I think we played Trailer in its entirety in there. We did like an acoustic set. Mm. We did like a greatest hits set, but like part of that was like showing bits of Slashed, and like Jed and Mark were up on stage talking about the whole thing, but there's never been a finished edit. So like Jed's gone on to like really big success in the film world. Well, I mean, he's done, you know, it was like last year he did Host, which is a huge thing.
I mean, that was a horror film for the pandemic, wasn't it? That was specifically and I know that it certainly stopped me doing any Zoom calls late at night, that's for sure.
Yeah, But yeah, so I think, you know, if it's ever going to see the light of day, we need him to just like sort of like do a rewrite that ties everything together. I've talked to him about it a few times, but you know, whether it will ever have the time to do it, I don't know.
I kind of hope it does, because I like what I saw. I think it's like about a 6 or 7 minute clip of basically, like, I mean, spoilers, virtually the whole band gets killed by an axe murdering ghost bride.
Yeah.
You seem to come off worst out of everyone. Your death is probably the more bloody of all of them.
Yeah, I honestly can't remember, but I'll take that. That's probably down to my acting skills.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Your ability to kind of spit out gallons of blood by the looks of it.
Yeah.
Going forward, you know, through the idea to release the A to Z, like basically what it was, you decided that after the Innocence album. Was it after the Innocence album?
Yes, after Twilight of the Innocence. Yeah,
yeah.
I think we actually announced it just we announced that we weren't going to do any more albums just on the week of release, because we kind of seen how things were going with, you know, like iTunes had, you know, blown up massively, and it just seems like album sales were like falling off a cliff edge. You know, the amount of albums you needed to get to number one was just like dwindling, but single sales were just, you know, like single tracks were going crazy, you know, like people were just cherry picking tracks, and we were just like, you know, what's the point in doing an album if no one's going to listen to it?
Mm.
And you know, it's like we'd always had this thing that we wanted to move with the times, and I guess that this was probably a case where we probably moved maybe a bit too quickly, because but I think the reason why we did it as the album was coming out, because we felt like, you know, we're just at the start of an album cycle. We've got this great idea, and we don't want anyone else like saying they were the first to announce this, like before we get to the point where we can release it. So we were like, you know, albums are over. We're in the future, we'll be just going to put out single tracks.
Mm.
And it seemed like, you know, it was like there's articles about the death of the album like every week coming up, and I think to us it felt like the whole music industry was just, it was in a panic, but it wasn't really proactively going, right, let's seize this and then turn it to our advantage, which is what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
So that's where we come up with the idea of, you know, it's like the idea was just to put out singles. I think we first of all thought we'll do one a month. And I think stupidly, I said, well, The Wedding Present have done that before. and then Tim and Mark were like, what about we did 26 in a year, put out one every 2 weeks? I was like, sounds like a lot of work.
And of but course, you managed that, it.
Of course, that's what we did. Yeah. I mean, I think the kind of concept of it, and we did it as a subscription thing, so it was almost preempting streaming, if you like. You know, pay this up front, and you'll be part of this subscription thing for a year. So I think if we'd had another maybe 500,000 subscribers to it, they probably all would have been top 40. I think they all just like missed out by a really small amount, unfortunately. But you know, I think if it had been just that little bit bigger, it would have had a little bit more exposure and a little bit more longevity to it. But
I wonder if it was maybe just a few years ahead of its time as well. It sounds like something that's possibly viable now.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I mean, I guess it was a case of, you know, we didn't want anyone stealing the idea, and we felt we had to do it pretty soon. I don't know. It's just it was definitely a weird time, but I think creatively it was quite liberating as well, because we weren't thinking about, you know, a cohesive record. It was almost like we kind of enjoyed the idea of putting out like a single which is going in one direction, and then putting something out just going wildly in the other direction. You know, it felt like there was a lot of like opportunity in the idea, you know, just to keep it interesting and fresh, you know, not just for fans, but for ourselves. And I think in a way we were maybe harking back to when Kung Fu had come out, and Girl from Mars and Angel Interceptor, Goldfinger. You know, I think one thing that we loved back then was like this idea that we could confound people's expectations, going from, you know, like a punky Kung Fu into like these two like kind of like space pop songs, and then into like Goldfinger, which is a much darker, different beast as well. So I think that's kind of where we were coming from, like from a creative point of view. But unfortunately, from a commercial point of view, it didn't quite get over the line, which is a little bit disappointing. But I think we're all proud of, you know, what we achieved in that year.
Definitely, because it like you say, it's a lot of work to put out a single every 2 weeks.
Yeah,
and like you say, to have them not all basically be the same song, which would be very easy to do. But do you think that and also the way that people listen to music now has kind of changed the way that you approach writing songs, you know, with maybe putting choruses up front or minimizing the intro length or things? Do you even think about that kind of thing when you're writing now?
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because if you look at 1977, like, oh, pretty much all the singles have a reference to the chorus straight off. And I think I don't think we've ever done it to that extent before. And it's just, I guess it does make a difference. It gets those hooks like out there right away. But I don't think we've done it as much as we actually used to in the start. So it's like, it's almost like we've gone backwards.
Gone the other way.
We're totally doing our career in reverse, you know, start off with the number one album and then do all this like obscure stuff afterwards.
I think that was the kind of natural way of doing things anyway, wasn't it? You know, you had, you know, well, actually yes and no, because there are some bands that you think like Pink Floyd would never have got to where they are now had they come out, you know, a couple of years ago producing some of that really weird psychedelic stuff, and then eventually like 9 albums later get to Dark Side of the Moon, you know.
I think we have a view where we're quite lucky. I think it was those, you know, the experience of those first 3 albums has kind of like stood us in very good stead, because we've had this, you know, massive success, then we've had a difficult time, which, you know, I think may have split up other bands, but it actually somehow it kind of brought us closest together. And then having that sort of like that, I guess, resurrection with Free All Angels, it's like through all those experiences, I think anything we've done post that, we've kind of like had this inbuilt resilience from what's gone before. You know, it's like no matter what sort of knocks we take or whatever, we feel like we can. That there's more in us, you know.
But it seems to be bearing out, because you've clearly got a fan base that wants albums as well, because you've done pretty well with, like, you know, Kablamo, and Teenage Wildlife did really well when it came out as well, the compilation, probably the best charting one since Supersonic Sevens. So yeah, clearly there's a want from the fan base to have that kind of collection of songs.
I know, you know, like albums like Kablamo and Islands, which is our last last one we put out. I mean, in terms of sales, you know, they haven't particularly, you know, like bothered the top 10 this time around. But I think, you know, like for us creatively and in terms of consistency, I think that sort of step away from albums with the A to Z has made us to kind of reevaluate like everything we've done, really. And I think we have a better idea how to make a strong album these days. I mean, if you look, like, I think the consistency across those last 2 albums is really good. I think the songwriting's great and the production's it stands up. You know, it's like it was very much our mantra when we went back to the albums. It's like, you know, it's like, right, we're going back on what we said, but so, you know, we can't fall flat on our face. Again, pressure from ourselves. It was a case of, right, you know, especially with Kablamo, was this needs to stand up to Free All Angels, and it needs to stand up to 1977. And maybe it doesn't quite have the big singles on it, but it has this, for us, it has the songwriting consistency.
Definitely, yeah.
an amazing thing to do, you know. It's like, and I guess, you know, I guess it is that pressure we put in ourselves to live up to, you know, past stuff that keeps us kind of thirsty for what happens going forward.
Mm-hmm. And mentioning islands as well, I mean, you had Damien O'Neill and Mickey Bradley from the Undertones on the track Buzzkill as well.
Yeah.
You know, did you actually get to work with them, or did they provide their...
Unfortunately, not. No, I think it was it was quite late in the recording process, and I think Tim was pretty much done actually, and he was in Northern Ireland doing there was like an acoustic thing, and the Undertones were doing it as well, and he was sort of, I think he might have been doing backing vocals. He just done the backing vocals to Buzzkill, and watching them, he's going like, oh, wow, I really kind of ripped them off in those backing vocals. So he was just like, hang on, you know, why don't we just ask them to do it?
Yeah.
So I think he ended up just like sending the files to them, and they recorded it and sent it back. So unfortunately, none of us were there, but, you know, it really works. And I think when we launched the whole Islands thing, we played in Belfast at Radio Six Music's biggest weekend.
Mm.
And they got up on stage with us.
Oh, brilliant.
To do that and Teenage Kicks. So yeah, at least we got to do it with them for real, which was great.
Oh, that's brilliant. Because yeah. they're a massive, I love that band.
Yeah.
I think there's so much more than just Teenage Kicks. But there's an interesting kind of link, kind of escapism in the way that the Undertones were writing songs about, you know, love and chocolate bars and things like that.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, obviously they were in the middle of, you know, the Troubles. Obviously, when you guys were starting out, there was still kind of a hangover of that. It wasn't,
yeah.
But you guys were writing songs about, like, space and kung fu. Like, there was a lot of kind of cosmic stuff going on there, and a lot of other kind of almost escapism type things. Was that a similar thing? Was the political situation up the road in Belfast, did it enter your lives in any way?
Yeah, I mean, it did. I mean, it's like, in terms of just being, you know, being exposed to it as you're growing up, you know, it's like we were born in the middle of the Troubles, and it's kind of like all we knew. You know, and, you know, we weren't, it's not like we weren't living particularly in specific flashpoint areas and stuff, but it's only just up the road, and it's on the news every night, and, you know, people... a girl I went to school with, her dad was a police officer, and he was killed,
right,
as well. So it was like, it's very close. And Tim's dad was a judge and stuff. So he had extra security at the house, and had to check under the car for bombs.
Wow.
So it was present. You know, it could have been worse. You know, obviously, but, you know. I think our thinking with the band was, it was more of an escape from sort of the everyday life, and the Troubles was like an everyday kind of presence in our lives. And plus, you know, when we hear bands like trying to write songs about it, it was such a complex, and still is such a complex subject. It's like, how do you put that in a 3-minute pop song, you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
Yeah, and other bands are more comfortable and into doing that, but for us, it was just like, you know, why do you want to write about these things that, you know, are that difficult? I don't know. It just didn't enter our head. I guess, you know, it's like Noel Gallagher saying, you know, why did, you know, I want to write songs about being a rock star. I don't want to write about, you know, it's like, you know, horrible, you know,
council estate stuff.
Council estate, yeah. Like underclass.
Yeah.
Although I haven't said that, he does mention that in the song, so that's blowing that theory out.
But yeah, so it was like, it was an escapist thing as well. So
yeah,
I mean, like I say, there's a kind of similarity there between the two bands, I think, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's one of those things as well. It's, you know, you can write a song about it, and people who are going to agree with your point of view are people who agree with your point of view. So you're preaching to the choir, you know.
Yeah.
I think to us, like, being in a band, I remember, you know, the first time we played in Belfast after 1977 and got number one, I remember being interviewed, and so I was like, you know, what we're doing here is we're bringing, like, two communities together who don't care about what religion they are or what political ideals have informed their lives. We've got 2,000 people in a room together, and that's more than any politician has managed to do so far. So, you know, to us, it was like music was, it reached beyond those boundaries that were all, you know, almost imposed on our lives from whatever back you're born into, you grow up with this view, and music was one of those things that it kind of meant, well, you don't have to have that view. You know, it's like, and you look at, you know, you look at even something like sport, you know, it's like you had, you know, it's like, bro, do you support Rangers, do you support Celtic and stuff growing up? And it's just like music didn't have any of that stuff attached to it. It was a total escape. It was a rejection of that kind of idea, you know. And it, you know, I can look back at that now and, you know, probably articulate it a bit better, but I think it was always a subconscious thing, you know.
But I think that's music in general, isn't it? Like music has always been, since like the dawn of time, has been like people getting, you know, our ancestors getting around a fire and beating on drums and blowing through hollowed out animal bones to create music. And it's always been a communal thing, even when you come right through to today with the most insane kind of EDM stuff. When the drop happens and you get that euphoric crescendo, everyone's in a rock gig where like the riff is going off and everyone is bouncing in unison. Everyone's got their arms around each other. Like it's a communal experience. And yeah, absolutely. Music has that power to bring people together.
Yeah, and it's cultural experience as well, because you know, it's like the most interesting music and where music develops is cultures meeting each other and being inspired by each other. Whereas, you know, it's like political divides attempt to separate cultures and say, no, there's us and them. Whereas, you know, culturally, music's about mixing this stuff and coming up with your, you know, your own unique take and multiple cultures.
And hopefully at the end of the year, we'll be back on tour again. I know you were saying at the beginning, you've got some dates in the diary kind of penciled in heavy pencil for September.
Oh man, just everything crossed. Yeah. Yeah, we, you know, be a bit, you know, it's like, who knows? But, you know, as long as the vaccines are seem to be on track, so we're still living in hope that that's going to happen. You know, we've got a few festivals in the calendar in August as well. It's like, hope.
Yeah, you're playing a festival with Adam Ant, aren't you?
I'll
Is
take
it
your word for
August? I think I saw a poster somewhere on,
it.
because I've been doing a lot of research on Adam lately because he's the latest documentary that I've put out.
Oh, cool.
I believe he's playing, I won't be able to find it now. He's playing a festival in Hertfordshire.
Okay, yeah. I probably saw it in a poster, but yeah. Yeah. I'd play with pretty much anyone at this point. So, yeah. Adam Ant's pretty cool. I think we did tech. We worked for Adam Ant for a little bit. He was from Belfast, and I think I think Adam was a little bit scared of Jimmy. He couldn't understand a word he said. He does have a thick accent. And he drinks a lot.
The other big thing, of course, is you know, hopefully things go forward in September and we can start, you know, going back to gigs again. But how from a kind of insider's perspective, if you like, how is Brexit going to affect touring bands and crews and merch sales and things like that?
Thank you for reminding me to apply for my Irish passport. I mean, we're probably luckier than most in the fact, you know, finally coming from Northern Ireland is working out for us because we've got dual nationality. But yeah, I mean, it still remains to be seen. It's just, I just hear horror stories about what it's going to be like. I mean, I've heard that, you know, in terms of like the music and infrastructure, I think that's going to be hit really hard. I mean, like tour buses, splitter vans, and stuff. Apparently, there's part of it is that they can only stop in two places when they go to Europe. So basically, that's taken the market for, you know, we can't rehearse in London hire a splitter van from across the road at the, you know, beside our rehearsal place, and then go and tour in that around Europe for 3 weeks. They're allowed to stop in two different places.
Wow.
So basically what we're going to have to do is either go to Ireland, hire one, and then go from there, which is obviously, you know, we can start our tour in Ireland, but generally we'll tour Ireland at the same time as the UK just because of geographical location, because it's difficult getting to the continent, or it's more difficult getting to the continent from Ireland than it is from London. Mm. Not anymore. So, you know, we might have to get splitters in. Maybe in Northern Ireland they'll be all right, or in the rest of Ireland they'll be fine. But it just throws in like a bunch of logistic nightmares. And, you know, it's like, even if we've got European passports, what about the crew as well? So we don't know how that's going to impact them as well. But it's going to, it's a disaster.
Yeah.
It's a disaster, and we're the lucky ones.
Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? I think the real, it seems to me like, unless you're a massive, you know, stadium band, it's probably going to affect everyone really badly, but probably the hard touring bands that are going out for the first time are probably going to be the ones that won't be able to do it, I guess.
Absolutely. It makes it like unviable for new bands. You know, it's like, we're going to spend that amount of money in visas. I mean, that's swallowing all your merch sales and more probably, you know, if you're making enough merch sales so you can go and eat at least when you're touring Europe, then you're just not going to be able to do it. But I mean, just going back to the cultural thing, I mean, there was, you know, the EU were putting out, you know, during negotiations, some form of solution. Now, that's been rejected by our government. Why is that being rejected by our government? Culture. They don't want in the mix. They don't want us to, like, bring back culture from Europe and turn Europe and going, oh, yeah, you know, we had a great time out there.
Yeah.
They don't want that happening. They don't want kids going out there as a band and going, oh, wow, this place is great.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
It's something that's been obvious to me since Brexit and almost, you know, was highlighted during the pandemic, was the current government's view on the arts as something that is a frivolity almost, you know, like the retrain, reskill advertisements that went out. I know that they were dreamed up many years ago, but the fact that they were drummed out during the pandemic, where there was no support for the arts or very, very little support for the arts. And it was all of a sudden, it was like, Fatima is a ballet dancer, but tomorrow she could be a computer engineer. She just doesn't know. And it's like, that's not, that's not it. People get into dance or music or art or whatever it is, because that's their creative output. That's how they make their living. That's how they, some people can't do a 9-to-5 computer programming job, and people don't want to do it. You know, it's
insane. I mean, I think it's one of the oldest professions. You know, it's like if you've got your basic needs met, like shelter and food, what do? You do something creative. You see, every single kid, you put them down in front with a blank piece of paper and a pencil. They start drawing stuff. They start being creative. You put a kid in front of a drum kit. They start whacking stuff, and they start coming up with patterns. It's an innate part of the human experience, and they're doing their best to. I don't know what they're doing. They seem to be trying with all their might to curtail it.
Yeah.
And why? I don't know.
Who knows? It seems totally draconian and, just backwards, absolutely backwards. And I hope that there's a solution somewhere once everything is being unpicked and redrawn. And, well, hopefully, you know, there'll be another government in power and maybe they can do something about it eventually. But who that will be and how they'll do that, I have no idea.
Yeah.
But, that's a bit of a down point to end the interview on, isn't it, really? what are Ash's plans for the future anyway? Obviously, you know, hopefully the tour in September, but you know, are you guys working on new material or
we're pretty much finished a new record. I mean, this is going to sound weird, but I finished recording the drums to it in August 2018.
Wow.
Or maybe
that's a long gestation period.
Maybe it was September 2018. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's bizarre. We like ever since we did Kablamo and went back to albums, we've always had this idea of, right, we want to get on a roll and get stuff out, but there's always been something that's gotten in the way. I mean, this time around, it's like it's good things and bad things. I mean, the good thing is that the record company wanted to put out Teenage Wildlife, and it's you know, it's a chance to, you know, re-promote the back catalog and sort of, you know, focus on, you know, past glories and stuff. But we were like, okay, great, but we want to get this new album out. And then obviously we didn't get to finish the touring for Teenage Wildlife, which we needed to do before we put out the new record. So I mean, in terms of finishing it, it's just been, the record, I absolutely love it. It's going to surprise, like, it's very different from Kablamo and it's very different from Islands,
right?
And the production, I think the production on it's very different from anything we've done before. I mean, still recognizably Ash, but I think it's almost like what A to Z could have been if it was an album rather than singles. You know, it's like there's a lot of different styles in there, and there's, yeah, but I'm really proud of this one, and hopefully we're going to take a lot of people by surprise in a good way. But yeah, I mean, just like just things getting in the way of sort of finishing it and releasing it with, you know, with COVID. And, you know, one thing I didn't touch on was like at the end of our touring last year, we cancelled the UK tour. Tim actually got stuck here. He was living in New York at the time.
Right.
We cancelled the tour on the which was starting on the 17th, on the afternoon of the 16th, which was also when America announced that they were stopping any foreign travel into the country at 4 a.m. the following day. So I mean, Tim probably could have like finished that call and then ran to Heathrow and gotten a plane, but he was worried about, you know, having been in tour, like taking anything back to the States and to his girlfriend. So he was like, I'll just stay in London for a couple of weeks. And a couple of weeks turned into, like, that was like mid-March. He didn't get home until mid-July.
Wow.
So, and plus he was moving back to the UK. You know, our like studio lease was running out in August as well. So the entire studio would pack up. So he wasn't in the best place to sort of be finishing stuff. So it's just been a series of things that have gotten in the way of this record, but nevertheless, I think it's quite a triumph in the face of several adversities. So yeah, can't wait to get that out. I think I've got the last mix has landed in my inbox, and there's a couple of recalls to do. So yeah, we just need to get working on that.
I'm really looking forward to that. It sounds great. I mean, I've had a really good time going back over the back catalog in the last couple of weeks in the kind of lead up to this, just to get my mind fresh into the kind of lineage of everything, like how it all fits together. And yeah, you're absolutely right when you say the last couple of albums have been as consistent as any other album that you've put out, for sure. Like, especially, you know, from Free All Angels onwards. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing what you come out with on the new album, if it's going to be like a complete mix up and a complete new kind of way of presenting a set of songs.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I look forward to it as well. I mean, it depends on how we like sequence and which. I think we've recorded about 15 tracks, and whether they all make it or not, I'm not sure. But I think regardless of that, it's gonna be an interesting journey for a lot of people.
Excellent.
Not least ourselves.
And I suppose, you know, we're all getting back into rooms again now. Is that, you know, and you were saying there's a little bit of trepidation perhaps about going live. Is it, I don't know, having the run through, having the kind of recording of the 25th anniversary gig, did that give you a bit more like, oh no, we kind of did slot back into our.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we've You know, I think it was just before I went down. I mean, he's like, I've not been, like, until last week, I'd not been, like, further than probably maybe a 10-mile radius, if I'm being generous. Like, my brother lives in that direction and our sound engineer lives in that direction, but it's like we're pretty close here. So the idea of going to London for rehearsals and stuff was just like, oh God, this is weird. But I think it was more the idea of it. Once I started doing it, sort of like didn't really think too much about it. And it was like, okay, like just getting into the room, that those 14 months apart just sort of like melted away. And I was sounding great as well. I was just like, I think the first day we tried to start with, like, we set up sort of late on the Friday after getting all our gear together and making sure everything was working after a year off. And we were like, right, let's do Lose Control. And we got like about a quarter of the way through it, which is like, wow, this is fast. But yeah, we get in the next day and sort of started with sort of built our way up to that. And we like smashed through the album, did Lose Control at the end. It was just like, wow, we're sounding better than ever.
That's excellent.
We should have a year off more often. No, we shouldn't.
Not again.
I think it's probably been something I've been very conscious of, especially over the last few months, like since I've known that this 1977 anniversary was coming up and we'd be doing the live recording of it. I've got a room just over there with a drum kit in it, and I just stick on my headphones. And the thing I'll be doing is just listening to like albums I've never heard before, like getting suggestions off people on Twitter.
Oh, I've seen those. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's been great. You know, just like I sit down for like an hour every day, and it's kind of like how I learned to play drums, was just putting on music and playing along. And you know, I've not done it in a long time, and it feels great. And for me, it's a great way to listen to music as well, because you're obviously, if you're playing along to it, your mind's like has to be focused on it the whole time. So
yeah, you're in the zone.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, brilliant. Well, it sounds like from what you're saying, you know, everything, hopefully, once we've all got the vaccines, we're all back in those rooms again. If you guys feel that way after being back in a room for a couple of days, then like the first couple of gigs back should be like almost, you know, hopefully that unity that music can bring will kind of feel normal again, and we'll have that communal feeling of euphoria again, I guess, at the shows.
Yeah, so. And I guess there's another thing just to touch on last week again was that there was all sorts going on. Like, there's like cancelled trains, there was missing tickets, there was like, I was staying at a friend's house who wasn't there, he posted keys to me, his keys went missing. It's like, I sliced my finger open a couple of days before going down there, like quite badly.
Oh my God.
And it was just like, just all sorts of stuff going on. Like, it's like, we haven't done this in you know, over a year, and all this stuff's going wrong. But it was just a case of, I don't care. It's just like, nothing is going to stop this. You know, it's like, you know, even if we're dying by the end of this, we're going to do this gig. So it's definitely like, you know, that was, you know, it was always going to be weird going back, but you know, it's like, it's just a determination that no matter what, we're getting in the room and we're going to make some great music.
That's awesome. That's so good. Against fate, almost.
That's the driving force.
But where can people find you? Obviously, you know, yourself, Ash, this live stream, where is that taking place, for example?
That's the live stream can be found at stable.com, which is stable.com. You can also find it, I think it's on the homepage of ashofficial.com, and we'll be badgering you about it on all the social media channels.
Absolutely.
over the coming month or so,
yeah,
as well. So yeah, you'll find it. You can find me on, I usually live in Twitter these days. For some reason, it's become my cesspit of choice over the last over the last year. Don't know why, but yeah, I'm on there, Onion Rick.
And people can keep on suggesting albums for you to drum to.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'll play along to anything once. Yeah, it's been a great way to find some new music. Don't ask me what albums they are. I'd have to go and look at Twitter again to remind myself. But it's
Awesome. Well, it's been great talking to you today, Rick. Thank you so much for taking time out. I know we've gone slightly over the time that I wanted to keep you today. But yeah, thanks for coming on, man.
That's all right. I've been looking for something to fill that drum-shaped hole after last week. So yeah, this has done it.
Excellent. Good stuff. Thank you so much. And hopefully I'll see you in the flesh in future. Who knows, at a gig.
Fingers crossed for that. Yeah.
Brilliant. Well, thanks very much, mate. And talk to you soon.
Yeah. Cheers, mate. All right. Yeah. Pleasure talking.
There you are. What a totally down-to-earth gent. I really hope you enjoyed that chat as much as I did having it. Once more, a massive thank you to Rick for giving up his time to talk to me, and I can't wait for the live stream this Saturday. And hopefully the tour in September goes ahead. Again, if this is your first listen to Band Biographies, please do go through the back catalogue of episodes that I listed in the introduction. And don't forget to subscribe, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and get in touch with me wherever you can, be that Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or via email. Thanks for listening. Thank you for listening to this episode of Band Biographies. If you enjoyed it, please don't forget to leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or whatever service you use to listen to your podcasts. Please do reach out on Twitter at BandBiogs, Instagram at BandBiographies, search on Facebook for Band Biographies, or by emailing bandbiographies@gmail.com. See you next time.
It's NFL draft season, and that means it's time to start thinking about fantasy football. FantasyPoints.com features industry-leading experts and prognosticators using proprietary hand-charted data to help you score more fantasy points. FantasyPoints.com is the place to go for whatever kind of fantasy football you play. Whether you play fantasy football, daily fantasy sports, or do a little bit of everything, Fantasy Points has the meticulously researched content to guide you to victory. And why wait for the fall? Fantasy Points also covers the new spring football league, the UFL. Join the guru, John Hansen, Scott Barrett, Joe Dolan, and other massive names in the fantasy football universe with an exclusive offer. Use code Pantheon for 15% off any Fantasy Points package, including the all-in package, with access to every article, tool, and data nugget that Fantasy Points has to offer. That's FantasyPoints.com and code Pantheon for 15% off at Fantasy Points. FantasyPoints.com, code Pantheon. Score more fantasy points.